From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we celebrate July 4th in the company of a great American director. We feature Martin Scorsese in conversation with film critic Roger Ebert. The interview was recorded at the Wexner Center for the Arts in Columbus, Ohio, earlier this year. Martin Scorsese is behind the re-release of the 1963 Jean-Luc Godard film Contempt. John Powers has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. On this 4th of July, a little bit of America has landed on Mars. The Mars Pathfinder, enveloped in a protective airbag, bounced onto the Martian surface and sent a radio signal back to Earth. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports over the next few hours, controllers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, will be awaiting some key signals to see whether all systems on the probe are working.
Step one will be the basic carrier wave signal to say all's well. Step two comes after 7 p.m. Eastern time when Pathfinder sends black and white pictures of itself back to Earth. These photos will tell NASA if the spacecraft has opened up like a metal flower the way it's supposed to. There will also be pictures of the mini Mars rover and its rollout ramp. The rover, nicknamed Mars Sojourner, is supposed to creep down the ramp just before midnight Eastern time and poke around the Martian surface. NASA picked a landing spot in the Eris Vallis region about 500 miles from where the Viking 1 spacecraft sits today. The two Vikings were the last U.S. spaceships to touch down on Mars 21 years ago. For National Public Radio, I'm Pat Duggins reporting.
Veteran CBS newsman Charles Kuralt died this morning. In his two decades of award-winning on-the-road reports, Kuralt savored the stories of average Americans who did unique or inspirational things. He also delighted in fascinating quirks, such as his report on the way time zones zigzag across the country with no apparent rhyme or reason.
Of all the states, Alaska is in the worst trouble. There they have Pacific Standard Time, Alaska Standard, Bering Standard, and a cutie called Yukon Standard. You can lose an hour any time you turn around, and if you go out with a boatload of Eskimos, you run the risk of losing a whole day.
Kuralt died of complications from lupus. He was 62. Charles Osgood, his successor as host of CBS News Sunday Morning, said Kuralt was simply the best writer in television news and a journalist who cared. Hardline lawmakers in Pale, claiming to have the support of Serbia's president, have ignored an order by Bosnian President Biljana Plavšić to disband the country's parliament. Lawmakers went ahead instead with a session to try to remove her from power that could put them on a collision course with international mediators. A fife and drum corps set a patriotic tone for ceremonies at the National Archives in Washington today, marking the 221st anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. A former history teacher wearing colonial garb read from the document.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Lines of people are winding their way into the archives to view the original Declaration document. Divers have stopped their search for two men missing since a fireworks barge exploded on the Mississippi River last night. They say there's little hope that they survived. You're listening to news from National Public Radio. The World Health Organization says there are now more than 1.6 million people worldwide with full-blown AIDS, and the number is growing at a rate of nearly 20% a year. The United Nations Health Agency says these reported cases, though, represent only about a fifth of the total believed to have the disease. The captain of a Japanese tanker that spilled 400,000 gallons of oil into Tokyo Bay says he was maneuvering the ship away from two fishing boats before it hit a shallow reef and ran aground. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
Ship owners investigating the cause of the accident say the captain cut the engines of the huge tanker as two smaller ships approached, and the Diamond Grace was carried by heavy currents toward the reef that ripped it apart. Maritime Safety Agency investigators, meanwhile, questioned the captain for possible negligence in connection with the spill. Some 700 ships, including more than 100 tankers, transit through the congested Tokyo Bay each day. And Japan's leading economic daily, the Nihon Keizai Shimbun, said, with all that traffic, the government should have assumed an accident like the one Wednesday was inevitable. By today, maritime authorities said the oil had split up into several slicks. While cleanup is progressing, there are concerns about the extensive use of chemical dispersants to break up the oil. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
The Kremlin is denying a report that Russian President Boris Yeltsin may seek foreign aid to pay back wages to public sector workers in his country. In an exchange captured by TV cameras, the country's finance minister told Yeltsin it was impossible to pay all the back wages in the next 3 months as he wanted. Looking flustered, Yeltsin said, "It is possible if we all pull together." I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, transforming the bounty of the American farmer into value-added products to feed a growing world. ADM, supermarket to the world.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're spending this July 4th in the company of a great American director, Martin Scorsese. We're going to hear him interviewed by film critic Roger Ebert at the Wexner Center for the Arts on the campus of Ohio State University. The interview was recorded in February when Scorsese was awarded the Wexner Prize for Originality in the Arts. The prize came with a $50,000 check, which he donated to film preservation. Scorsese is currently completing a film about the young Dalai Lama called Kundun, scheduled to open in December. Roger Ebert's latest books include Roger Ebert's Book of Film, a Norton anthology of the best writing about a century of film. As you'll hear, Scorsese and Ebert illustrated the conversation with film clips, which we've edited and bleeped for broadcast. Here's Roger Ebert with Martin Scorsese.
You kind of have a habit, a very nice habit, of making the best film of each decade.
I hope so.
I don't know. I don't know what these critics' polls mean.
I know.
It doesn't mean anything to lose one.
No.
It probably means something when you're selected, when they invite hundreds of critics to vote on the best films of a decade. And when they asked the various critics groups and assemblies about the best film of the 70s, it was Taxi Driver.
Really?
And we'll leave everybody in suspense as to what the best film of the 80s was. That will come later in the program.
Yeah.
But Taxi Driver, to me, really represents that feeling. It's like the summit of personal cinema. And about the time Taxi Driver came out, we started to get the giant multi-million-dollar blockbusters, the special effects pictures. All due respect to people like Lucas and Spielberg, but Jaws and Star Wars changed the rules, and we When Taxi Driver was made, it wasn't as unusual as it now seems.
I know, because you're talking about a time, you have to understand, everybody, that the number one box office film of all time for since 1939 to 1972 was Gone with the Wind. 1972, The Godfather Part 1 took over. 1976, I think, Jaws. Mm-hmm. And everything changed.
And then 77 might have been Star Wars.
Star Wars, and that was that. So it's become like a whole other thing. It's almost like a different industry in a way. Mm-hmm. But this was you know, a film that we really believed in, Taxi Driver. It's really, you know, I have to admit, I mean, not admit, but it's important that everybody understand that the impetus and the whole presence behind the picture is Paul Schrader. It's very important, and it's not to dare to sound generous, but the idea is that one has to understand that it came out of his guts in a two-week period when he was alone in L.A. and very depressed. So it's real. It really is real. You know.
Let's look at the clip, and then I have a couple of questions for you.
This clip is Harvey and Bob.
Yeah.
When he first meets Harvey in the street. Mm-hmm. There's a little improvisation in this. Yeah, a little bit.
Some action?
Yeah.
You see that guy over there?
Yeah.
Right. You go talk to him. His name is Matthew. I'll be over there waiting for you.
Okay. I went to Chinatown. Your name Matthew? Want some action? Officer. I swear I'm clean. I'm just waiting here for a friend. You gonna bust me for nothing, man? I'm not a cop. Then why are you asking me for action? because she sent me over. I suppose that ain't a 38 you've got in your sock.
38?
No. Huh? I'm clean, man. Shit, you're a real cowboy. That's nice, man. It's all right. $15, 15 minutes, $25, half an hour. Cowboy, huh? I once had a horse in Coney Island. She got hit by a car. Well, take it or leave it. If you want to save yourself some money, don't f*** her. You should be back here every night for some more, man. She's 12 and a half years old. You ain't never had no pussy like that. You can do anything you want with her. You can f*** on her, f***ing in her face, man. She should make it explode. But no rough stuff. All right? All right, I'll take it. Hey, man. Take out no money over here. You gonna f*** me? You're gonna f*** me. You're gonna f*** her. You give her the money. Yeah. Catch you later, copper. What'd you say? I'll see you later, copper. I'm no cop, man. Well, if you are, it's entrapment already. Huh? I'm hip.
Buddy, you don't look hip.
Okay, now, share with everybody, you were talking about De Niro when he was listening.
Yeah, when he's listening to Harvey give that litany of what he could do to the kid, you watch his body, freezes, and he's so full of anger and violence, and you think he's like a stiletto. He's about to pounce on him, you know? And Harvey, the more he did that, if you watch Harvey, the more Harvey closed in on him. Because they sort of played off each other beautifully, you know? And that's why it's all in a two-shot, you see? Until finally we do the closer shot of Bob and the closer shot of Harvey. And even in that closer shot, you can see where he moves back this way. He does a strange thing with his back. And it's from driving the cab, too. He has this kind of interesting look of always being prepared for anything, you know? A lot of that was improvised by Harvey, especially the stuff at the end. He says, I'm hip. And he goes, funny you don't look hip. So, and also it's entrapment. And this thing here you got from my mother, which... She one time, I think she told Harvey something. Oh, yeah, that guy, he's in jail. She said, like this. So we threw it in, you know.
Looking at them in this scene, it might be a good point in the evening to talk about these two remarkable actors who have been associated with you in so many films over the years. And you were the first to use Keitel. You were not the first to use De Niro, but nevertheless, you and De Niro are linked in everybody's minds.
Eight films.
These two actors and your career cannot be thought about apart from
that's right. That's right. That's what we were talking about earlier yesterday. I think the idea of what collaborators really are, you know. And finally, I mean, with Keitel, I found that we just kind of knew a lot about each other's feelings and about life and how to live one's life, the guilt, all of this sort of thing. We all worked together, and we kind of understood each other and trusted each other a lot. And it was always, especially on Last Temptation, playing Judas, we had a really good time, mm-hmm. You know, really good time, because we couldn't get it, in rehearsals, we just couldn't stop talking about the implications and the variations of all the different levels of meaning in just the situation itself, not the book or the gospel, but the situation and the beauty of that situation. And we'd constantly get hung up enjoying the possibilities, the discussions, what if, and all that sort of thing. De Niro's a similar way, but we find that if the script is strong enough, we don't really talk that much about the project. We usually talk about, you know, personal stuff, and which he said at the American Film Institute last week. He said, Marty and I talk about personal things, which is between us. And that's that. That was it. That is between us. So, you know, it's one of those things that you find on Taxi Driver. We became very close, I think. And
they're two different.
Yeah.
Having interviewed both of them from the journalist point of view, with Keitel, you ask a question and you get an hour of great quotes. The most interesting quote I ever got from De Niro was, yeah?
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. Yeah, that's not. Why? The thing about De Niro is that why should he have to say it? It's up there.
We're listening to Martin Scorsese in conversation with film critic Roger Ebert, recorded at the Wexner Center for the Arts on the campus of Ohio State University. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to Martin Scorsese, interviewed by Roger Ebert at the Wexner Center for the Arts in Columbus, Ohio.
We could move on to Raging Bull, and I want to just say one thing to begin. It came out in 1980. You know, when they give awards, they have this persistence of memory thing, like the Academy can never remember a movie they've seen earlier than December.
I don't know how
the movie
that
came out last
that,
July.
Know.
We can't
I
remember
know.
It, frankly. We didn't know it was this year's film. Sorry. You know. So this Raging Bull came out in 80, and 10 years went past. And yeah. At the end of the 80s, there were three different attempts to pick the best film of the 80s. Premiere Magazine asked everyone they could think of, and two other groups. And all three picked Raging Bull as the best film of the 80s. 10 years later, there hadn't been anything since like it. It is a great film. It is a film that will live as long as films are seen. And I think that...
Thank you. Thank you.
What I feel so strongly in talking to people about movies, frequently people will, they know I'm a movie critic, they will discuss the subject matter as if that is what the film is about. Oh, it's a film about boxing.
Yeah, I know.
Or,
right.
Oh, it's a film about gangsters or
right.
Whatever, you know, like when they hear what Breaking the Waves is about, I don't know if I want to see it. A film is not about its subject, it's about how it's about its subject.
Right. In fact, when...
Subject is neutral. People don't understand that. When people say, whenever anybody makes a statement, I don't like to go to movies about, and then fill in the blank, my response is, anyone who makes that statement is an idiot.
No, it's true. It's true.
I don't want to go to bad films about cowboys.
Yeah.
I don't want to go to bad films about boxers.
I know.
I would like to see a good film about a boxer. Might be a more intelligent statement.
Yeah. I mean, when Bob gave me the book originally, it's back in 1974. I never saw a fight scene. I never saw a fight. My father's a big fight fan, but I didn't know anything about boxing, and I wasn't interested in films about boxing. You know, but it took those years to. For me to go my own way, to come back to understanding really what it was about.
It was about a boxer, but it wasn't about boxing. It was about the boxer.
It was about a man, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could you set this up just a little bit by talking about two things? Number one, what people don't always, they observe viscerally, but not necessarily intellectually, how much technique went into the boxing sequences in terms of slow motion and how, and lenses and movement of camera.
What happened with the boxing sequences, once I saw De Niro perform the... nine fights. They had Jake LaMotta and Jimmy Nicholson worked out blocking for nine fight scenes, and he showed him to me in Gleason's gym on 14th Street, and I sat there, I was stunned. In fact, he came over to me, he says, are you watching? Because I'm killing myself. I said, yeah, I am. And I realized, I said, oh boy, I said, because he didn't know, I thought I was like, you know, hanging around, not watching it. I'm watching, I realized, you can't shoot this. You can't shoot this from my angle. I said, we have to be in there with him, and it's gotta be the Wild Bunch. It's gotta be, every punch has to be worked out in such a way, or let's say, not every punch, but you have to do it like music. You have to do it like I did some of the musical sequences in New York, New York, where three bars of music was one shot, literally. Not four cameras, and then you cut it together in the editing room. That's selecting, not directing. It's a different thing, you know? But directing is, you know, these four punches, one, two, three, four, camera tracks from left to right, swings around over the shoulder of the guy who's getting hit, and we see a close-up of LaMotta hitting him. And it's got to be an arc, like this, and as fast as the punches. Then do it, then on the set we began to understand that we couldn't even see the punches, they were so fast, we had to go higher speed. 36, 48, 96, that sort of thing, just to see them. In this you see all the speeds. But what happened was that I drew out every shot for each fight scene. There are nine fight scenes in the film. One, I didn't draw out the shots. I think it was the second Sugar Ray fight, but I decided they was doing it with long lenses. And we put a bar of fire in front of the lens, So the heat ripples. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing was that the camera never, as much as possible, never goes outside the ring, that you're always in the ring with him. Your sensibility is taken on by his sense of, his vision becomes your sensibility. In other words, what he perceives in the ring. Sometimes I open the ring up. We had a ring that I built special where I made it longer, and sometimes wider. Mm-hmm. And it was like imagine being punched in the head. What you hear and what you perceive, you don't know where you are. It's all hallucinatory.
You used breaking glass.
Breaking glass
and animal noises.
Animal noises and that sort of thing. Frank Warner did that. He wouldn't tell us after a while what he was using. He said, "I'm not going to tell anybody. You know, that's whatever it is. It's great. It's, you know, that sort of thing. Pulling out the sound, putting in the sound." We even changed speeds during a shot, which now you can do very easily with a button, but then you had to actually do with a non-blimped ARRI, and you had to change the motor and also the left stop with two assistants, that sort of thing. But in any event, what I'm saying is that it was all designed, and they were all designed shot A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and they all were cut together. And some of the cutting of the fight scenes was the easiest to do because it was all laid out. Mm-hmm. But it did take, we had planned 5.5 weeks of shooting for it. It did take 10 weeks. And it was very specific. And De Niro would have on the side of the camera a very big punching bag, one of those cylinder ones. It looks like a cylinder. And we were ready to yell. We were ready to go for a roll. We'd have the slate ready, you know, and start rolling. And you hear off camera, punching the bag. And then he'd jump into frame, sweating, you know, and then the slate. Mm-hmm. So he came in already heated, bang, ready to go. It wasn't like, wasting any footage. But the physical stamina it took him to sustain 10 weeks of that was amazing. And because he believed in the shots I wanted to get. But what you see here is the final battle, in a way, and the punishment he takes, especially the montage when he gets beaten up by Sugar Ray, is based, in a way, the drawings I made were based on the shower scene from Psycho. And I shot it in that way. There were 39 shots. And it took 10 days just to shoot those shots because there were applications and all kinds of makeup problems. And just to get the angle right, it was like 10 days. And there's even a shot in there Sam Fuller told me about. He said, put the camera in the lens. Put the lens in somebody's hand and just swing this way. Right? You'll see it. We even put the camera on the boxing glove, and the glove is in the foreground and comes flying at him this way. It's all in there for like maybe 5 frames, 6 frames, you know.
Let's look.
You know? Okay.
We have LaMotta on Spear Street holding on. Well, certainly that was one of the most damaging evidences of punching that you have seen in recent years.
Come on! Come on! What are you standing for?
Robinson, apparently tired, punched with a fairly well and rocked Jake LaMotta right to the heel.
Come on, Ray. Down, Ray. You hear me?
Never got me down. Yeah, see, look.
Thank you. It's a killer. Thank you. One thing I forgot to say before it started was that the announcer's voice, that's the actual announcer of the actual fight. The phrases he used, and it was hard to get his voice out through the stereo and that sort of thing. It's hard to hear sometimes, but the lines he used is amazing. No man could take this punishment. That's all real. That's actually as it was happening, you know.
Obviously, the film is in black and white.
Yeah.
It came at a time when you were involved in a battle with Eastman over the fading
color
stock, but yeah. Apart from that, didn't you believe that this film had to be in black and white?
Yeah, I believe that because an old friend of mine, Gene Kirkwood, walked by my office and remember Sweet Smell of Success. That's a great film by Alexander McKendrick with Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis, really sort of based on Walter Winchell, mm-hmm. and had extraordinary black and white photography of New York and that world, really, James Wong Howe photography, 1950-something, 55, I think, 56, 57. Anyway, I thought of that, and I also knew that there were four or five other boxing films coming out that year. There was the main event, Barbara Streisand, and a comedy.
John Boy,
was it?
Yeah.
It wasn't John. It was
Jackie.
Ryan O'Neill.
Ryan O'Neill. That's
Ryan,
right.
Barbara Streisand, and there was Rocky II or Rocky III, I think, and there was a couple of others, and there was even Matilda, the boxing kangaroo in color.
Right.
I said, think of it. I said, Oz is the only one in black and white. It's got to be different, you know. But the studio was extremely nervous about that, and we had a meeting with David Field and Stephen Bach, I think of UA at my apartment in New York at the time, because I was living in both places at the time, New York and LA. And I think it's in that book, Final Cut. He describes the meeting. Interesting about Irwin as a producer, he's really quite good, and he would never let me know the difficulties surrounding the picture as it was working. For example, he told me, he said, guys, you know, David Field, they're very nice guys, actually, David and Stephen. They just want to come up and see you and Bob at the apartment just to talk to you and just, you know, check in on the script and see how things are going. Just, it's a purely personal, it's a hello, goodbye meeting, that's all it is. I read Final Cut, and they're coming up in the elevator thinking they're going to cancel the picture. I said, I didn't know that. This is amazing, you know. And then one of them said something about who cares about, and they were very nice about it, but they wanted to know, I explained the black and white to them, and they went with that. And then they wanted to know why we'd want to make a film about this guy. This guy's like a cockroach. It's in the book. And De Niro just looked at me and said, he's not a cockroach. And they bought that.
Martin Scorsese with Roger Ebert, recorded February 28th at the Wexner Center for the Arts on the Ohio State University campus. The occasion was Scorsese's acceptance of the Wexner Prize for Originality in the Arts. We'll hear more of the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, The Last Temptation of Christ and Goodfellas. We hear more of the conversation between Martin Scorsese and film critic Roger Ebert. And John Powers reviews Contempt, the 1963 Godard film, which has just been re-released as part of the Martin Scorsese Presents series.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we're featuring Martin Scorsese in conversation with film critic Roger Ebert, recorded in February at the Wexner Center for the Arts on the campus of Ohio State University, where Scorsese was awarded the Wexner Prize for Originality in the Arts. About 2,500 people were in the audience as Ebert interviewed Scorsese about his movies and his life.
Now, your Roman Catholicism has been very important to you throughout your entire career. You studied to be a priest at one time. Mm-hmm. Did I ever tell you that I did too?
How old were you?
I was, they had kind of a summer camp at the seminary.
Uh-huh.
And it was real thrilling. You got to smoke with the seminarians.
Oh, yeah.
That, I remember that better than any of the religion part of it.
God.
The Last Temptation of Christ is the most overtly religious of your pictures in terms of its subject matter. And probably comes out of a lot of feelings you had about the passion and death of Christ growing up as a Catholic in that world.
Yeah. Now, there's no doubt that the that was the most incredible theatrical experience, without being disrespectful, for an eight-year-old, was going into the St. Patrick's Old Cathedral for the first time and seeing a mass and seeing those statues, the plaster saints and the statues of the body of Christ lying in the sepulcher. Laying in the sepulcher. They're no longer there, the church, after they shot Godfather in there, they changed the statues and things. They got some money. It's no longer the same. But the, sort of modernized it in a way. But the older plaster statues of the saints, the old Italians, the old Sicilians and Calabres grew up with, it's so great. And it was so vivid, And the use of color and the suffering of the saints. It was really something that for a 7 or 8 year old to go in there and see a high mass, it was quite a theatrical experience. But I mean, religious, but also at the same time, something that has never left my consciousness. And I guess by the time we got to do this scene in Last Temptation of Christ, I think I got carried away because Paul Schrader's original script was very short. It was very short, and what he wanted was. The story of Jesus, the known story of Jesus from the Gospels, based on, of course, the Kazantzakis book, which is, as we have to say again, is purely a story. It's not the Gospel. But you take everything that you kind of know about Jesus up to the point of the crucifixion, and that's only like an hour and 15 minutes into the film. And the audience will be wondering what's going to happen, because that's the end of the story. There's a resurrection, and that's it. And instead, you go into the Last Temptation. But Jay Cox and I rewrote the script about 7 times, actually. And there were lots of things in Kazantzakis' book that I wanted to put in, particularly a scene between Jesus and a monk played by Barry Miller where Jesus confesses to the monk, because I felt that what was interesting was that there should be a direct connection between Jesus as a man and God to the man in the street. Mm-hmm. I mean, he should be preaching on 8th Avenue and 52nd Street, this Jesus, you see, in the worst part of town, and helping, taking care of the beggars and the prostitutes and the killers and everything. That's the Jesus that we wanted to do. But it was a it was very difficult to shoot the picture. Still, to this day, I think it's the hardest thing we've ever done because of the limit of money and time. And in the case of this crucifixion you're going to see, we shot it in 2 days from sunup to sundown, and we did 75 setups. Actually, I had about 100 setups, and we cut them down.
On a typical day of shooting, an average picture by another director might get
6
four,
to 10.
Six.
6 to 10. 10's a good day. Okay, so let's take a look.
Mother Magland, where are you? Stay with me. Don't leave me.
forgive.
Thank you. Thank you. I just want to make it clear that those were edited. Those sequences were edited. Actually, there's more to that, and I think Thelma put like three sections together. But there's a lot more going on.
There was an international protest against the film from some Christian, fundamentalist Christian.
Fundamentalist Christian, yeah, which is a different.
And I remember getting calls because I thought it was a great film, and people said things like, they showed him nude on the cross. And I was saying, it's okay to crucify him as long as he's wearing a jockstrap, right?
Exactly. Well, you said it. I mean, all of a sudden they're going to put nails in there. Oh, let's cover him up.
It's okay to put the nails in because...
Yeah. I said, no, I've seen that in art. I saw it when I was a kid at the Metropolitan Museum. There was an incredible, I don't know who did it, a wooden sculpture of the three crosses and the two thieves and Jesus naked on the cross. That's obviously the truth. I mean, imagine being on that cross for 3 days.
I think that people have sentimentalized Jesus to such a degree that your film, which I think was done in the total spirit of this story, was too much for people because they want to gentle it down somehow into more palatable images.
No, it raises a lot of questions, the truth of it, I think. And I don't know. I mean, I just wanted to make him one of us, in a sense. He came, the film Christologically is as a number of the religious... there's an Archbishop of New York, Episcopalian, and a number of my friends of Catholic priests talked about the correct Christologically correct, they call it, and that Jesus is God and man in one. Mm-hmm. That's the one thing we assume. Okay, bang, we go in with that. And Cousin Zach is too, you know, in the book. And the idea then, if it's man, then he has to be afraid of dying.
And so he has to be capable of lust.
And he has to be capable of everything, yeah. And the whole idea, what I thought was so great about Cousin Zakas' book was that the last temptation is not for riches or whatever, just to live a life of a common man, to have a family, to die in bed, and that sort of thing. It's almost the love that he has for mankind, you see, the love he has for us. Mm-hmm. That's the idea. And in order to die, he has to know that what we go through. If he doesn't know what we go through, what good is God, you see?
We're listening to Martin Scorsese in conversation with film critic Roger Ebert, recorded at the Wexner Center for the Arts on the campus of Ohio State University. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to Martin Scorsese in conversation with Roger Ebert. In this part, they're discussing Scorsese's film Goodfellas.
The thing about this scene, this particular scene when Henry and Karen enter the Copacabana, illustrates something that it's famous because it's one take, and you can talk about that.
Yeah.
But it's also illustrative of another thing, and that is your constant use throughout your career of a moving camera. And a moving camera, in my way of thinking, is subjective and evolving, just as a static camera is objective and distancing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Your camera often is moving even if the audience isn't aware of it.
That's right.
Film,
yeah.
To implicate the audience in the action. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Emotionally and psychologically into the action. Mm-hmm. I mean, I find that one of the key things, for example, in Taxi Driver was that you had to see practically everything from Travis's point of view. Otherwise, you wouldn't go with him when he killed those people. You wonder why. I mean, not that you know why, but you'd have to understand the feeling. You know that something terrible is going to happen, and here it goes, and I'm with you because I'm inside him. Mm-hmm. You see, as much as you can get, and therefore lots of point of view shots. And very often when we did the point of view shots, his point of view, we did slower speed, that sort of thing. If you look at Taxi Driver, rarely I think. If it's a two-shot, and I'm De Niro, and this is Albert Brooks or Keitel, on Brooks or Keitel, we're over the shoulder of De Niro. He's in the frame. But when we cut to the reverse, it's only De Niro. And it was the kind of thing I had in my mind, that he can impose himself into their world, but he's always an outsider. Mm-hmm. And I think that it helps psychologically set him apart from the other people. Anyway.
Let's look at this. You want to set this up, or?
Henry taking out his wife-to-be to the Copacabana. And in a sense, it had to be like royalty arriving, make straight the path, where you take stones off the rock, or the rocks off the path so the king could come by. And he's seated in the front seat, the best seats in the house. And it's probably the only time in the picture where you see his reward, or what he thinks is a reward.
For being a wise guy,
you know?
And let me ask you one more question. I was asked today, after this was shown earlier, well, doing it in one take, was that just a stunt to prove that he could do it?
No.
I had an answer to that, but I'm not interested in my answer, excellent as it was, but...
Ah. No. You see, the whole point was that the camera has to go with him so that it takes you through the labyrinth, and then finally you come out and you're treated like a king. And it all has to be in one. And when you think it's just about over, because the place is crowded, the camera pans and the table is being floating through the air. And they put the table in front of some other guys, and they sit down, and we think it's over then. Well, Mr. Tony just sent us some champagne, so you got to pan over to see Mr. Tony, wave to him, pan back. And finally it ends on Henny Youngman saying, take my wife, please. You know, and the point is that it had to be a kind of virtuosity that reflected the exhilaration of that lifestyle, because that's the danger. You see,
and isn't
that's
it
the
also,
danger of that lifestyle.
To some degree, isn't it Karen's POV? She's seeing what his gift is
to
her.
Yes, yes.
If I go with this guy, the waters will part for him and I can walk along in his
life. Oh, yeah. She admits it later. She says, I got excited by him, you know, by hiding the gun. She liked it. You know, turn her on.
Let's look.
Excuse me.
Oh.
Henry.
How you doing?
Henry, nice to see you.
Yeah, good seeing you.
Hi, how are you? Anthony, right in the front.
Great, thanks.
Anything you need, Henry, just let me know.
Hey, how come we can't get it?
I know you're waiting for it, Henry. I'll be right with you.
I have another train.
You know, I gotta tell you one thing that I didn't make clear is that, you know, for me, when I was growing up, the Copacabana was like a palace. That was, you couldn't get any higher in style and class. I mean, you know, to see Frank Sinatra at the Copa. My friend who passed away last year on Good Friday, the same age, Dominic, his father was the bartender at the Copa Lounge. And once a month, they would go on the house to see the show. You know, and that was part of the perk he would have. And they saw Sinatra there many times. I mean, it's just amazing. I never got to see Sinatra there. But we would go, and it was really like, I mean, you couldn't get any higher in terms of, in my mind, this was like the epitome of everything. This is what we wanted to aspire to. And every now and then, a number of times we went, and we'd have seats up on where he came in, and we says, oh, nice to see you. And the fellow with the blue jacket, who, by the way, was the real maitre d' of the Copa in the late 50s. And... we had seats up there, and we could see the show. It wasn't too bad. But sometimes we get seats down in front. Mm-hmm. And we said, boy, this is great. This is great. And all of a sudden, the table would come in. So, right in front of us, two tables, and Mr. Fischetti and Mr. So-and-so, and who knows, you know, a number of names. Oh, a Big Tony here. And then, you know, God forbid, the big problem, as Nick Pileggi would tell you, the big problem is if one set of wise guys were upstaged by another set, then there was a war. And there was a lot of trouble sometimes. We were like, you know, hoping that we could at least see the show. But my graduation prom night, Cardinal Hayes High School, we went there. We saw Bobby Darin there, you know. And it was a wonderful place. I mean, it was really fantastic. Great
now,
Chinese food.
When you said action
yes.
here, you said into motion a lot of action, because you were just telling me during the shot that all the extras standing outside in line to get in, the moment that the camera goes inside, they all run in because they're the extras inside.
I didn't know that. You see, what happened was that I had to take 14 or take 15, and by the end, I would say, okay, let's do one more. And by the 15 take, I heard the whole audience go, oh. I said, what's the matter with them? They're sitting down. What's their problem? And Barbara then told me, Joe Reedy, who was my AD who set up the shot, said, we ran out of extras. There's the people waiting on line outside. While the camera's going through, they're running down and getting into the chairs. So let's do a bunch of more takes. Let's go. Well, that was Barbara. I didn't know. Remember, we just couldn't get the, we didn't have enough extras. And, I mean, we made the film for $25 million, you know. And when I told it to Spielberg, he said, oh, still working low budget, huh? You know.
Thing about that shot that I noticed, as he's greeting the people behind him, one he greets, the guy in the blue suit sits down slowly and looks at him in awe.
Yeah.
Now, he's just an extra. But it was a great performance because it showed that he felt this person was to be feared and respected.
Powerful, powerful. He knew powerful people. And although Henry himself was a nice guy, the people he was connected with were very powerful. And you had to be very respectful of him. Because as I could say, it could be a war any second. You've got to be very careful. Now, also what's interesting about those extras around, they're not really extras. Those are guys from my neighborhood, from my old neighborhood that, Nicky, no, what's his name? Oh, what a nice guy. Well, whatever. He became an extra, and I got him, he acted in a few of my films. He works in a lot of films in New York now. Frank Aquilino, I think. And Butchie, his name is. He wears a hat like Bob wears in Mean Streets. And he went down to the neighborhood. Another guy, Johnny Cha-Cha, went down. And they gathered up all these guys, and they brought them up there. And they said, you'll be in a film, you know. But the problem was, they'd never been in a film before. They'd been sitting there all day doing that shot. And the problem was, they understood that they were then going to be in like actors, and they're going to get SAG cards and everything. And it was hard to explain to them. Where they would grab the AD and say, when do we get our card? You know, so no. It doesn't work that way.
But maybe for you it works that way.
Yeah, for you, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're putting money in the AD's pocket. No, don't take it back, please. Please. The poor guy.
We're almost out of time. Let me just ask you a final question that probably won't take you long to answer, since it probably cannot be answered. Mm. What have you learned, and what do you know for sure about it all now, as the, in my opinion, the best director we have? Mm. What can you tell us?
What I learned is to be aware of myself, to be wary of myself, and to be wary of becoming complacent about what I can do. And it was so freeing. I got so free when I realized that ultimately I'm not totally sure. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, I know. I mean, I'll go on a set. I mean, I'll have a script and I'll see something, bang, it hits this way, Age of Innocence, shoot this, shoot that way, and then go. But there's always something as you're trying to transfer that thought and that note and the little drawing from paper to a lens, and then from the lens, my God, what size lens? Where do you go? You know, very often I know what size lens, but still, what's in front of the lens? Is there something wrong? And you realize that once you know that all possibilities are there, it's open, wide open. Be prepared for everything and anything. The idea is you can't be prepared for anything. You can't be prepared for everything, but what you could be prepared for is not to feel shocked when you don't know. Because if you start to get nervous with yourself, you're only going to get irritable with everybody around you and say, I knew it, and I should have done it this way, and that sort of thing. You be okay with yourself. If you don't know it, just go with it and try to find it. Mm-hmm. Try to find it with the actor. Try to find it with the DP, with the director of photography, and take it a little easier on yourself. And that's the one thing. It makes it scarier, but it makes it also more, at the same time, it's interesting. It's scarier, but also more relaxing.
Martin Scorsese in conversation with Roger Ebert, recorded in February at the Wexner Center for the Arts in Ohio. Scorsese's film Kundun is scheduled for release in December. Roger Ebert's book, Questions for the Answer Man, is about to be published. Our thanks to Bill Horrigan and Sherry Gelden at the Wexner, and we thank Scorsese and Ebert for letting us broadcast their conversation. Martin Scorsese is behind the new re-release of the 1963 Godard film Contempt. Scorsese paid homage to that film by using music from it over the closing credits in his film Casino. Here's that music, composed by Georges Delerue.
Thank you.
Music from the film Contempt, just re-released as part of the Martin Scorsese Presents series. John Powers has a review after a break. This is Fresh Air. Martin Scorsese's involvement with film has extended to lending his name to the re-release of such films as Rocco and His Brothers and Belle du Jour. This month, Scorsese presents the re-release of Jean-Luc Godard's Contempt, a film Scorsese has called brilliant, romantic, and genuinely tragic. He also says it's one of the greatest films ever made about the actual process of filmmaking. John Powers has a review.
In 1962, producers Carlo Ponti and Joseph E. Levine hired Jean-Luc Godard to direct a sexy potboiler starring Jack Palance, Michel Piccoli, and Brigitte Bardot. But Godard has always been the movie's most iconoclastic genius, and he turned Contempt into an attack on precisely the sort of racy, lowbrow fantasy that Ponti and Levine expected him to make. Piccoli plays Paul Javal, a once-serious writer whose wife Camille is played by Bardot. Paul gets approached by Palance's character, Jeremiah Prokosh, a thuggish American producer who's making a version of The Odyssey with the famous director Fritz Lang. Prokosh wants Paul to rewrite the script to make it trashier. He likes the idea of topless mermaids. Although Prokosh is a Hollywood barbarian defined by his red sports car, Paul is still tempted by the offer, even after Prokosh comes on to his wife. Although Paul pretends not to notice, Camille certainly does, and Contempt turns into something of a debased modern version of The Odyssey. The ambivalent Paul must try to win back his wife and deal with the suitor Prokosh, a man who feels no more inner turmoil than a hungry lion, as is clear when, during a boat ride off the Isle of Capri, he's licking his chops over Camille.
Jerry, Joe Levine is calling at one from New York.
Why don't you come up to the villa with me and leave them here to talk?
Venez avec nous, madame. On les laisse discuter.
Non, j'entrerai à pied avec mon mari tout à l'heure.
She's going with her husband.
Oh, come on. You spend all day with him. Come on.
Monsieur Foucault, je dis que vous êtes toute la journée avec votre mari. Paul.
You mind if your wife comes along with me?
Est-ce que ça vous ennuie que votre femme vienne avec vous?
Over the years, Contempt has become something of a grail for film lovers, who've been forced to endure seeing the movie exclusively in bastardized versions, with terrible dubbed dialogue, sound that muffles Georges Delarue's music, one of the most haunting scores ever, and scanned prints that shrink Raoul Coutard's legendary widescreen images to only half their original size. I would love this movie for its ravishing beauty alone, yet this is only the beginning. At its most visceral level, Contempt offers an incomparable anatomy of a marriage with all its shifting moods and psychic fault lines. During one extended 30-minute scene between Paul and Camille in their apartment, we see how he treats her as an object of his fantasies. We see her disgust at his willingness to prostitute both his talent and to pimp her to Prokosh. We see Paul insist that he's doing it for her, to pay for the apartment that she loves. And we see her contempt at his refusal to own up to his own actions. As the two bathe, argue, fall silent, paper over their differences, and drown in mutual incomprehension, Godard actually shows us a love going dead. He also shows us the movies being murdered by the crass Prokosh, who is Godard's hilariously vicious portrait of the men who hired him to make Contempt. In a sense, this story is the reverse of those Henry James novels about innocent Americans meeting corrupt Europeans. Here it's the old world that seems innocent next to the gangsterish Yank who has the power to make them jump. Where does this power come from? The Nazi Hermann Goering once said, "When I hear the word culture, that's when I reach for my revolver." Prokosh wields a far more modern weapon. "When I hear the word culture," he tells Paul, I reach for my wallet. Prokosh strives to buy everything. Directors like Fritz Lang, writers like Paul, movie stars like Brigitte Bardot. Camille is the defining role of Bardot's career because it's the only one that doesn't exploit her status as a sexual icon. When Godard first finished the film, Ponty and Levine were outraged that he hadn't shown Bardot naked. That's what she was there for. And they ordered him to shoot a nude scene. In a brilliant act of subversion, Godard did just that. When we first meet Camille, she's spread out naked on a bed like a piece of meat, and she's asking Paul, "Do you like my bottom? Do you like my back? Do you like my breasts?" Deliberately unerotic, this is a nude scene that unmasks the cold-blooded way that Bardot and all sex kittens have been used by the movies. Shortly before his death, Levine was asked about Contempt, and he replied by cursing Godard's name. "I gave him Palance. I gave him Bardot. I gave him Capri. And what did he give me? A great big piece of that's what he gave me." For the record, what Godard gave him, and you'll probably never hear me say these words again, is one of the greatest films ever made.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Bob Purdick was our engineer today. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Martin Short about comedy, acting, and singing. He's starring in the new film, A Simple Wish. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.